Could there be a delay in the death penalty trial of the Parkland shooter? Examining the police response to the UPS truck robbery and shootout, plus restoring coral reefs in the Keys. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Lawyers for the confessed Parkland shooter want to postpone his trial on 17 counts of murder and 17 counts of attempted murder. Why the delay? Dozens of shots were fired when police confronted thieves in a hijacked UPS truck on a crowded street corner in Broward County. Why the firefight in rush hour traffic? And the effort to restore coral reefs in the Florida Keys. It's all ahead on a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. It's made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. This is a pledge edition of our program, and the pledge line is open here during our conversation. It's the red donate button ready for you at WLRN.org. The trial for the confessed Parkland shooter is scheduled to begin with jury selection next month. Nicholas Cruz faces 17 counts of first-degree murder and 17 counts of attempted murder for the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School last year in Parkland. A Broward County judge is expected to consider a defense motion to delay the trial, though. That was filed this week. A decision could be coming soon. WLRN's Broward County reporter Katie Swatowski covered the hearing. She joins us now via FaceTime audio. So, Katie, what is the argument in this defense motion to delay the trial beyond its scheduled start right now, which is late January?
There's actually a couple of reasons. In this huge motion that the defense team filed this week, they lay out three or four, and they use more than 30 cases as examples to go over. One of their, I think their main argument is that 20 months to prepare this case for trial is less than half of the average prep time that Broward Circuit courts have permitted for capital cases in the last 20 years. Hmm. And it would bring this case to trial faster than 33 of the 38 death penalty cases in Broward since 1994. And that's all from the defense's motion. But they point out that in Broward, of the cases they mention, the defendants have not actually been executed when it comes to death penalty cases. So their argument is that they simply cannot do their job if it's going to continue with jury selection on January 27th, that there's just no way that Cruz could get a fair trial. And they're really worried about how fast this is going. Now, they've got a couple theories on why that is.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, while they argue that this process for a death penalty trial is faster than normal for Broward County, what are their arguments for as they see it, why it's moving so fast?
The defense or the prosecution?
The defense, in the motion that they make to try to delay this trial, as they make that argument that this thing is moving faster than normal.
Well, one of their arguments is that the judge on the case, Judge Elizabeth Shearer, is up for re-election in 2020, and that could be affecting her decision to move as quickly as she is. And the defense is also arguing that the lead prosecutor on the case, Mike Satz, he's been our state attorney in Broward for 44 years, and he's stepping down. So the defense argues that Mike Satz is looking to get this wrapped up before he leaves office and sort of end his career on a landmark case like this. Hmm. There's nothing about this case that's like a normal capital case. You've got 34 victims, so many pages and social media posts to go through, photos. There's more than 1,000 witnesses identified by prosecutors that all have to be interviewed by Cruz's attorneys.
Yeah, the defense was arguing, I think, that there's dozens and dozens and dozens of witnesses, millions of pages of documents that they have to go through
About 4 million.
4 million pages of documents in order for them to put on the defense of the confessed Parkland shooter. So how are prosecutors, how have they responded to this motion for delay?
I think one of their reasons is because this is not like a typical capital case. They don't want it sitting on the books for years and years. And so part of their argument has been, it's not a normal case, so we can't treat it like a normal case. And we need to make sure that for the sake of the community that we're in, you know, the state's looking at it as, if we get this done and done right soon, we have to put the community through less re-traumatization. The defense argues that by doing this so fast, and possibly needing other trials or getting this tied up in appeals if it's not done right, that will cause more re-traumatization to the community in the long run.
Now, early on, there were reports that while the Parkland shooter confessed to law enforcement about his actions here, that there had been an effort on the part of some defense lawyer that potentially if the death penalty were not the risk here, there may be some other result in the strategy of the defense. But prosecutors had been reluctant and had rejected that kind of negotiation. Is that still accurate?
I think so. It's always still on the table that if the death penalty were to be taken off the table here, that Cruz's defense team says he would plead guilty and be willing to, you know, serve the rest of his life in prison. And that's an argument. So 34 life sentences, some argue, take away the complication of trying to get the death penalty and just sort of get the theme here is get this over with. But yeah, I think at any point, if the death penalty comes off the table, you have a totally different kind of case. And death penalty cases, they're held to a higher standard. There's a different level of accuracy required by the law when the government is trying to take away someone's life. And so that's very much a part of this.
You are listening to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. It is a special pledge edition of our program, and the pledge lines do remain open online. That is the red donate button at WLRN.org. We're speaking with WLRN's Broward County reporter Katie Swatowski about the latest on the upcoming trial of the accused and confessed Parkland school shooter. Katie, this hearing this week, it was open to the public, as most of these hearings are, and you were there in the courtroom, in the courthouse, and ran across a curious audience. Tell us about it.
I did. Normally I see law students in these hearings, or occasionally Cruz's brother Zachary comes to sit in the audience in these hearings, but I had not before seen a group of a field trip of sorts of seventh graders come in and sit behind me in this hearing. Turned out there were 11 seventh graders from Apollo Middle School, and they were all in a law studies class, but they were on their routine annual field trip to tour the Broward County Courthouse. And I got to talk to their teacher. I kind of went over and I asked her about it. It did look a little curious. And she told me they had the opportunity that the courthouse offered to let them come sit in on this hearing. And so it raised a couple of questions, and of course the debate on educational value for 12 and 13 year olds versus potential trauma, anxiety, and risk. And so in my talking to the teacher, I learned, you know, she thought the kids could relate to this. They know the case, they knew what happened, and they were on lockdown that day, according to their teacher, and that this would be an opportunity to see some of this play out. Now I did get to talk, of course, to the school district about this afterwards, mm-hmm. if this was a known thing going into the field trip, and it wasn't. So the school district kind of gave this caveat that on the field trip forms parents signed, there's the possibility that their child could go into a hearing or a trial to observe. The question about that is, I think it's not that the kids were in a hearing, it's that they were in this hearing.
Right, right.
And that the defendant was there talking to his attorneys a few feet away.
And so did the school district respond to that, or the teacher? And what was your sense of the kids themselves in the courtroom?
The school district did respond. They were unaware of it before I'd asked them about it, mm-hmm. it seemed. And they told me that the principal at Apollo Middle School, which is in Hollywood, has been continuing to investigate, and he's in contact with these families about this exact issue. Now, the kids in the courtroom seemed like regular 12 and 13-year-olds. I didn't see anything that concerned me for the kids, mm-hmm. but that's not to say, you know, each child does not bring their own.
Yeah. Katie Swatowski covering Broward County, and among the stories this week was a motion hearing for the accused and confessed Parkland shooter. She was in the courtroom for that hearing. Katie, always great to have you on the roundup. Thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Still to come on this special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup, questions, lots of questions still remain in the wake of the UPS armed robbery caught on live TV in a crowded corner of South Florida in traffic. That's still to come next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. It was something out of a movie, a pair of armed robbers hijacking a UPS truck in Coral Gables last week, a police chase crossing county lines and then resulting in anything but a Hollywood ending. It was a deadly shootout in Broward County between several South Florida law enforcement officers and agencies and the thieves. The two suspects were killed, as well as Frank Ordonez, the truck driver, taken hostage, and a civilian bystander. The FBI and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement are now conducting investigations. Broward prosecutors are in charge of looking into whether police broke the law. Lots to talk about in this case as it continues to unfold about what happened and when it happened and the actions that were taken or were not taken. CBS4's Jim DeFede has been covering the story. He's with us via FaceTime audio. And also Miami Herald reporter Jay Weaver is with us on the telephone. Fellas, welcome back to WLRN. Jim, let me begin with you. Any new details emerging about the incident in terms of kind of the order of the violence? Who shot first when the truck eventually stopped in traffic?
No, we still don't know that. That's the part of the investigation that the Florida Department of Law Enforcement is handling. When you have that many sort of shots being fired, and my reporting is that it's upwards of 200 rounds fired by at least 18 different officers, it's going to be a little hard to figure out exactly to track which bullets came where, when, and who fired first, whether the shots were fired when the truck was stopped at the intersection. We do know that the bad guys in the truck were firing during the chase itself, mm-hmm. that after they had left Coral Gables, as they were heading up the highway, they were firing at officers. So we do know that there was gunfire at that time. But when it stopped at the intersection, we still don't know exactly who fired the first shot.
Jay Weaver with the Miami Herald, the state's attorney's office here in Miami-Dade County shifted the case to Broward County. What were the circumstances for that kind of investigatory shift? Jay, you with us on the telephone?
I'm with you.
There you go. Now we can hear you now. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, what I was going to say was I think you have to take a step back overall because there is a lot of tension between law enforcement agencies. And David Ovalle, my colleague at the Miami Herald, and I reported on this tension in a story published yesterday about how the FBI and FDLE are kind of at cross purposes because the FBI jumped into this investigation immediately after the jewelry heist on Thursday afternoon a week ago. And the FDLE is, of course, investigating the police-involved shooting that resulted in the four deaths. And so there's conflicts over who gets to review the ballistics first and who gets to review other evidence. And the FBI is holding back some of it as it relates to the robbery suspects, and FDLE has some of the evidence as it relates to the police. And, you know, you have two jurisdictions, in effect, two counties, Miami-Dade and Broward. Mm-hmm. You have an armed robbery that occurred in Coral Gables. Mm-hmm. You have the chase that involved various law enforcement agencies. And then you have the shootout in Broward County. So you have multiple moving parts. And as a result, you're naturally going to see tension here. And the FBI jumped right into it immediately afterwards. And a lot of people were scratching their heads as to why they did.
Well, and so what's either precedent or and why does it matter who is the kind of lead investigatory agency on this as the public searches for answers in terms of some of the law enforcement conduct, but also law enforcement is also asking questions about itself and what it can learn from this. So, Jay, why does it matter who's leading this investigation?
Well, I think at this point it does matter for one simple reason. Everybody knows these two robbers robbed the jewelry store Regents on the Miracle Mile in Coral Gables at gunpoint. and then had a getaway car. It was a U-Haul rental van that, you know, they drove away in, but then eventually broke down. And then they carjacked a UPS driver's truck with the driver inside and then led law enforcement on this wild chase. Well, the reality is, it was, you know, we already know the outcome of all that. Mm-hmm. The two robbers were eventually killed in the shootout in Broward. So what people want to know is the other innocent bystanders, the killing of the hostage, Franco Donez, mm-hmm. and the killing of a innocent bystander in a car, a Rick Cutshaw, a union organizer. And the reality is people want to know, did police bullets kill the UPS driver and the motorist, or did the robbery suspect kill them? And so I think deferring to FDLE would be the order of the day so they could finish their investigation faster. I'm not sure how much the FBI contributes from the criminal investigative standpoint, because we already know what the outcome of that is.
Yeah.
That's why there's a lot of tension.
Jim DeFede, we don't know yet the bullets that were fatal to the driver and the bystander, where those came from, correct?
That is correct. Although all of my reporting from various law enforcement sources, they're bracing themselves for the likelihood. Again, we don't know, but the likelihood that the two innocent bystanders, the Frank Ordonez and the truck, the hostage, and the gentleman who was sitting in his car, will probably be the result of police gunfire. And that's why this is really important, to get back to your point as well as to what Jay was making, which is that the problem in cases like these is they often take on their own years to resolve.
Right.
I mean, when I say years to investigate, there was a similar case in Miami a few years back that took forever to sort of get through. And so as a result, you can't learn the lessons that need to be learned from something like this. And I know that there's been a lot of debate about, you know, were the police justified? Was it appropriate use of force? I think that the key questions that will need to be asked going forward are, what is on not just the audio tapes of 911 calls, but more importantly, the radio transmissions,
right.
The helicopter transmissions? Because what you get there is you'll get a sense of, you know, this was more than a 30-minute long chase. Was anybody in control? Did anybody take the lead from law enforcement, any agency, call way this should go down and how it should play out? And let me just make one other quick point. The second thing is, I know people, you know, are critical of police, you know, in terms of the number of shots fired, and the police have a justification that they believe supports it, and that they have to intercept, that they have to act quickly in cases like this. They cite Parkland. But let me just tell you, the lessons that I've learned from previous shootings like this is that the police officers are supposedly trained that they are not allowed to discharge their weapon unless they have a clear target in sight. In other words, they can't just shoot at the truck because they hear gunfire. Mm-hmm. They have to have one of the bad guys directly in their line of sight that they are firing at. And that's the question that needs to be answered, is where did the bullets come from? And did the officers, you know, really have a clear target that they were aiming at when they fired their weapons?
What are the post-Parkland questions here? And I'm thinking there's kind of two categories, Jim DeFede and Jay Weaver. One is, you just touched upon it, DeFede, in terms of the communications, right? I mean, we have had and seen and learned tragic lessons about communication difficulties in the moments of and immediately after the Parkland tragedy in terms of police communications and security communications. We also have seen the tragic consequences in the debate around police engagement with active shooters. So I'm wondering how Parkland has changed potentially the questions that are being asked in the investigation, and could influence the outcome.
Well, let's make a comparison here that's crystal clear. At Parkland, the communication broke down entirely. There was no communication. The problem here, and this is to Jim's point, is that Miami-Dade had a chopper in the air, and they had a dispatcher. And then they had various law enforcement, Coral Gables, Miramar, Pembroke Pines, and then the FBI eventually jumps in, and then there's FHP. But from what I've heard, the communications over the radio channels that were being directed by Miami-Dade police were not crystal clear. That's why this led to so much. That's why this may have led to so much chaos and lack of control, because there was nobody formally directing how to handle the chase. You know, they missed opportunities possibly to cut off this van, this UPS truck as it was going heading north. And then they end up engaging with these robbery suspects in a crowded intersection. And as a result, two innocent bystanders were killed. You know, everybody says the robbery suspect shot first. Well, if that's the case, fine. But to Jim's point, you know, they came right at them, the police, you know, law enforcement, and there were some four or five agencies there, 19, 20 shooters, and they just, you know, fired away. And it was stunning, you know, because everybody in the community wants to know, how could they have let something like this go so out of control? I don't think there was a lack of communication. I think there was a lack of direction.
Jim DeFede, how about this question about engagement, the law enforcement engagement in these active situations that that has been so front and center in a post-Parkland conversation about these kinds of violent acts happening?
So I think that one of the justifications using after the fact is the idea that in Parkland, officers were criticized for not directly engaging with the shooter at the time of the shooting was taking place. And that because some officers held back, they were viewed as cowards, they could be fired, they could be criminally charged. I do not believe, I would be very skeptical in believing that any of the officers involved in the UPS case had that on their mind. I think this was a highly stressful situation. I think the adrenaline was flowing in these officers. I think they had been shot at along the roadway. I think they saw an opportunity. Now, there was a concern articulated by police, and this may be legitimate, that they were afraid that the gunmen were going to start firing or taking additional hostages of some of the people in the cars around the truck. And so they needed to move forward. But there's again, this is why we need to go back to what the police procedures in a case like this should have been, could have been. Would they have been able to stop the vehicle at a different location?
Yeah, and Jim, you mentioned your reporting. I think you said 18 officers discharged their weapons.
We know of at least 18.
18, and across how many different law enforcement agencies were those 18?
Four agencies.
So now you've got four different engagement policies to investigate. You know, could there be differences in those policies?
There could be, but again, the point that Jay and I have been trying to make here with regard to quote-unquote communication is that typically you see that in a long-running chase like this one was, and again, this chase lasted more than half an hour.
Right.
Somebody will step forward, a lieutenant, somebody, a captain, somebody in an agency will say, okay, this is how we're going to be handling this. I want six units ahead. I want this many units here. I want to close off these intersections. I want to try to work them into this area. Let's put out, you know, sticks on this area. You know, someone calling the ball, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Somebody out there who is trying to organize and bring this to a better resolution than having the truck stop in a crowded intersection. This was the worst case scenario. Now, let me again be clear. The people responsible for this are the two criminals, the two gunmen who started this. If not for their actions, no one would be dead. But we do have to examine what happened here. And there are things that going back to your very original point, which is the cross-section between FBI and FDLE, yep, is that they are not forthcoming with information. Like, we should know we shouldn't be trying to analyze, is it 18, is it 19, mm-hmm, is it 20 officers? We should know that specific number. And if they want to release the names, which I think they should, of those officers, at the very least, they can identify information about those officers. One of the questions I would have right away is, how many years on the force,
yeah,
the officers who fired their weapons, how many years of experience that they have? My guess is we're going to find that most of those officers were probably, from what I've been told, under 5 years,
yeah,
on the force.
It's certainly a central question about particulars around the specific agencies involved, the specific officers involved, and their background and experience, as well as their training with these kinds of situations. Still lots of questions. Jim DeFede with CBS4, thanks for sharing your reporting with us, Jim. Always great to have you on the program.
Absolutely.
Jay Weaver with our partner, the Miami Herald. Jay, nice to have you as well. Thanks for sharing your insights with us.
You're welcome, Tom.
We've got plenty more here on a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. How about diving and fishing giving way, perhaps, to environmental conservation in South Florida waters? That's all ahead as the South Florida Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Don't forget the pledge lines and the pledge button online still waiting for you and your support. Thank you for supporting public radio. Federal and state officials are trying to strike a balance between conservation and public access to South Florida waters. Florida Fish and Wildlife agreed to back tighter fishing limits in Biscayne National Park on Thursday this week. Fish populations in the bay have been dwindling. The commission is also considering a new plan for the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary. That plan would restrict access to some popular reefs. Several scientists are researching ways to restore the corals that have been decimated by disease and pollution. So let's talk about the environment throughout South Florida, just in our nearby waters, with our environmental reporter, Jenny Stiletovich, and WLRN's Nan Klinger covering the Florida Keys in Monroe County from our southernmost bureau at the studios of Key West. Jenny, let's begin with Biscayne Bay here. Florida Fish and Wildlife commissioners met this week to talk about a new plan for fishing in the bay.
That's right. So Fish and Wildlife sets the fishing rules for Biscayne National Park. It's a national park managed by the federal government, but there's an agreement between the state and the feds so that the state can set those guidelines for fishing. And what they have essentially decided is to limit the number and size of some popular fish to try and help revive these dwindling fish populations.
What kind of fish are we talking about here?
Snapper, grouper, really popular fish.
Oh, yeah. Everybody knows those, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
You don't go fishing in Biscayne Bay and not hope to get one of those,
exactly.
Right? Which I suppose is the problem, perhaps.
Right. So there's about 17 species that are down more than 70%. Those are really big drops in population. They set the goal at reviving those populations by 20%.
Over what kind of time frame?
5 to 10 years, okay. Is when they go back and take a second look. They originally were going to look at it every 7 years. Yesterday, they decided they would speed it up to five years. But environmentalists and some scientists say that 20% as a goal is not good enough, that instead of setting a number, it should be overall sustainability.
Hmm. Why are the populations down?
Overfishing. You know, there's
Without question,
the pressure from fishing down here is just enormous. We have grown in size. What are we, 6 million people?
Yeah,
now?
Up and down, right? Yeah,
right.
From Key West up to the Palm Beaches,
right.
Yeah, six and a half million.
And that
folks.
Translates to people on the water.
And those are people who just live here.
But,
those aren't
right.
The visitors who are getting
right.
out on the water
right.
as well.
Yeah. And I say overfishing, but it's also loss of habitat too.
Meaning
reefs are down. Yeah. The reef cover is down. I think in the last 40 years, the amount of coral cover is down 90% in our reef tract. So you get habitat loss. You get problems with, you know, the population declines, then it's just a cascading effect.
Which, Nan, brings us to you in Monroe County and those reefs just offshore up and down the Florida Keys. We'll talk about some plans to restore that were announced this week, or efforts. But describe those reefs today. If divers were to go down today, what would they see?
Well, as Jenny said, we have seen a 90% decline or loss of our living coral cover. So, you know, if you haven't been here before, you'll see some cool coral. You'll probably see a lot of neat fish and parrotfish and other species. And you might think that's really great. And it is really great. But compared to what people saw when they were diving here 40 years ago, even 30 years ago, it's really heartbreaking.
And you can hear that when you talk to longtime sport fishermen, Jenny, when they talk about the populations,
oh, yes.
Or you talk to divers or snorkelers that have been, going offshore on their own, or just going off a pinnacle camp near
if
Key Largo.
If you spend any time with a fishing guide, you will hear them just, you know, bemoaning the fact that the bonefish, some of the game fish that draw huge dollars,
yeah.
are just down. And by comparison, I mean, we do have the dry tortugas, like Nan mentioned, that people who, you know, compared to 40 years ago, you can go out to dry tortugas now and see what the reef track used to be like. It's a incredible
yeah.
place
the,
out
the
there.
Only difference, right, Nan, is that's a four-hour cruise from Key West compared to what could have been seen, what, maybe 10 minutes or so offshore.
Right. Well, it's like 2.5 on the ferry.
Okay, I'm thinking round trip. Fair enough.
Yeah. Right. Oh, it's an all-day trip, and yeah. It should be because it's worth it to go out there.
Yeah. So, Nan, talk to us about the news this week concerning the Marine Sanctuary and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and as that agency looked toward a new goal for restoring some of these reefs.
Yeah, they are really basically putting, I guess, feet in the water and saying that they want to restore 7 iconic reefs between Key Largo and Key West, from Carey's Fort off Key Largo to Eastern Dry Rocks off Key West. You know, reef restoration has really, or coral restoration and coral nurseries have really taken off in the last decade or so. And they want to put that to work on a pretty big scale. At these reefs, so that at least there are some places in the Keys that have healthy, resilient corals, which will be selected and bred from corals that have proven they can survive, you know, these bleaching events, these disease events, and all the other stuff they're facing.
Now, I'm a do-it-yourselfer, but I don't think there's a coral reef aisle at Home Depot. So how do you restore a coral reef?
Well, the folks at Moat Marine and the Florida Aquarium, and there's a group in Key Largo called the Coral Reef Restoration Foundation, have all been working on that over the last decade, figuring out how to grow corals and how to take care of them in these nurseries in the water so that they can survive.
And they're also doing lab bred coral too, right? I know University of Miami is working on some genetic modifications so that they're developing coral that are actually more resilient to the changing temperature from climate
change.
That's
right. Yeah, and the aquarium actually got some coral sort of giving birth, if you want to put it that way, or reproducing, let's say, this year in a new way. So that's really cool. That's really great news for this. But it's going to be a very intensive, expensive effort for, you know, 7 reefs.
So it seems like a large swath, certainly not all those reefs, but a large swath of reefs. It's a pretty, perhaps a big bet. What kind of financial resources are involved? Where are they coming from, Nan?
They say the first phase, which is expected to last 5 to 7 years, is expected to cost $97 million. That involves not just corals, but also the grazers that Jenny reported on this week, like mm-hmm. the sea urchins and some crabs that help keep the reefs clean and free of algae. Some of that's money that, you know, NOAA and other agencies are already putting into this, and they're looking for grant funding. They're looking for everything they can get to make this happen.
So we've got coral restoration efforts off the coast of the Keys, looking at trying to boost up some fish populations in Biscayne National Park and Biscayne. This is about protecting, encouraging the environment, but it also could get to limiting access or limiting the ability of the public to partake in some of these resources as the scientists try to address what has happened here. John Hunt is a biologist who manages the Florida Wildlife Lab in Marathon. He's familiar with this debate over proposals limiting access to some really popular reefs.
The intent is to limit overuse of popular reefs. And in generally, our key stakeholders, those people that, you know, I go to Publix with on a daily basis and ask me questions at, you know, when I'm there, routinely acknowledge that these reefs tend to be overcrowded and that they think in general, you know, that their actions are having an impact.
So, Nan, first, when it comes to the reefs in Monroe County, how is this going to play out? How is this playing with the with not only the native population, but also the hospitality industry?
Well, that was my first question when that was unveiled as part of this restoration blueprint back in August, because I was like, oh, my God, people are going to freak out about that. And they did. And they said right from the get-go, our intent is not to keep out the local boaters who understand how to navigate these waters. We just want to make sure that somebody from, you know, Indiana who has never driven a boat in a reef environment before isn't going out there and trashing the reefs. So, but one of the ways that they talk about doing this is to limit at least the commercial operators to Blue Star sort of certified operators. And that got a huge negative reaction from local boaters.
Describe Blue Star. Is that some kind of good housekeeping seal of approval or something?
Exactly, from the sanctuary. And they've just introduced it in fishing guides now as well. where, you know, you've basically done some training and you've agreed to doing best practices and, you know, just being really environmentally conscious.
Jenny Stiletovich, when it comes to Biscayne National Park and the fish populations, are we talking about limiting fishermen?
Well, so in the management plan, which is different from the fishery plan, the park in 2015 did include a 10,000 acre marine preserve, which would be a no fishing zone around reefs. That's a fraction of the 225 square mile park, but they got huge pushback from that. Senators Rubio and Eliana Ross-Leighton even floated a bill in Congress to block it. And so I think, you know, while they want to keep it open to local boaters, those tourism dollars are hugely important. So they're getting pressure from Boat US, you know, from the marine industry, the boating industry, to not set any kind of restrictions.
It's a familiar tension, right, that we see on land when it comes to real estate development and those that are looking for efforts to regrow mangroves or to shore up natural shorelines as defense mechanisms against hurricanes or even sea level rise, right?
Right. But park advocates will say, this is a national park. You know, this is our Yellowstone National Park. And if we have an ecosystem that is so threatened, we need to treat it that way. You have to get a permit to get in parts of Yellowstone. So they think that the same should apply
to moving in that direction
to Biscayne National Park. Well, no, because I think there is so much pushback. I don't think that management plan that called for the marine preserve that was passed in 2015 is still sitting there, not implemented. And I've talked to people and they say there doesn't look like there's any indication that that's going to move forward.
Jenny Stiletovich covering the environment for us here at WLRN. Thanks for sharing your reporting this week, as
Thank
always.
You.
And Nan Klinger, great to hear from you. Thanks for sharing the latest on the coral reefs off the coast of the Florida Keys. Nice to hear from you from Key West.
Thanks, Tom.
Nan Klinger, our reporter at the Southernmost Bureau in Key West at the studios of Key West. That'll do it for our South Florida Roundup here this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Leprey. News Director Terrence Shepard, Alicia Zuckerman, Editorial Director, Director of Radio Operations at WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. The WLRN Director of Radio Programming is Jason Zabka. Richard Ives is our Technical Director. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting WLRN. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.